Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back. You are listening to the weekly roundup on the Dialogue with Dewa De Boer and William McGimpsey on Reality Check Radio. And we take a little look back at what happened last week, especially the early parts of last week, maybe even last weekend. And in this weekly retrospective, and one of the suggestions we had to rename this segment as well, just keep bringing it up, Monday's Moot Points. So we're still considering that. We'll have a little internal vote on that in a few weeks. But for now, welcome back to the show, William.
Thanks, Dewa. Good to be here again.
And we've got quite a few different international issues to get into first today, as usual. And then there are probably a few parallels and a few things that we can develop locally, because that's usually what happens is what quite often things that are happening overseas, problems overseas, tie back into problems we're having here in New Zealand. But before we go into that too deeply, we'll just have a development on the elections in Europe. Well, we've been talking about those almost every show, either a local election or a national level election in Europe, where we see the right wing, or the what the media scarily calls the far right, is winning everywhere. And especially when it comes to young people, the youth overwhelmingly voting for these right wing parties. And they're the most kind of, I guess, authentically right-wing parties, traditionally right-wing parties, in terms of believing in their national identity and wanting to protect their national homelands. So the Freedom Party in Austria came in first place in the elections there about a week, just over a week ago now. Mm-hmm. And they got 30% of the vote. So the Freedom Party of Austria came in first place by a decent margin. The People's Party, which is the sort of the old liberal conservative party, came in at 26%. The Social Democrats at 21%. A new liberal, kind of left liberal party at 9%. The Greens at 8%. And they've even have communists over there in Austria, but they didn't get into parliament. So looking at the full list of parties they had, by the way, they even had a Gaza list. So we'll maybe talk about Gaza in a minute, but just fascinating the fact that you have effectively foreign interest parties in these European countries. They got 0.4% of the votes, which is quite a bit, 19,000 votes for a party that existed purely to care about foreign interests. And you can see that this is dividing the left quite a bit, because obviously the right in this election did really, really well focusing on their nationalist policies. So you've got any initial reactions, what you think is happening here in Austria? Is it the same as Germany? Probably. And then I've got a few follow-up questions on this subject as well.
Yeah, I think it's the same basic dynamic of the populist, nationalist, immigration skeptic parties tending to do well, with younger people. I think social media has a lot to do with that. And just the basic facts on the ground of the problems immigration's causing, the problems with migrant crime. In many countries, they're having problems with housing costs and basic services and benefits and things flowing disproportionately to these people. It's causing a bit of a drag on the economy and things like that. I don't know exactly what the details are in Austria, but I imagine some of those problems are in place there as well. The Austrian Freedom Party, from what I understand, they raised the remigration issue in the election, and that has obviously resonated. Remigration is a step beyond merely talking about reducing immigration. So it seems like as time goes on, people are becoming more comfortable with not merely reducing immigration, but taking the next necessary steps to correct the bad policy of bringing in too many people to start with. The other thing they talked about was skepticism of the Ukraine war and skepticism with providing continued funding. And this is another feature of some of these more nationalist parties, I think, in Europe. They're skeptical of EU policies, NATO policies. They're somewhat more friendly to Russia. So as I understand it, there's a bloc building up there of EU skeptic parties. So you've got Austria, Hungary, Slovakia, maybe the Czech Republic. I think that's the bulk of those parties that now have, depending on, I think there's still some elections to go in some of those countries, but there's a bloc there that can perhaps work together on immigration and some of the issues related to Ukraine and military funding and aid funding to Ukraine. So there's a bloc there that can work together on some of those issues. And I think that is interesting. It's an interesting development.
The Austrian People's Party, their sort of liberal conservative party, basically their version of the National Party, was polling, you know, basically the governing party polling very, very highly a few years ago. And then over the span of the previous government, they collapsed in support quite dramatically. I believe they allied with the Greens, who were similarly punished for their part in that kind of government to keep out the Freedom Party as it was at the time. And even now, the leader of the People's Party has promised that he's not going to go into a government with the leader of the Freedom Party. So you basically have the liberals are saying, no, we're not going to work with the scary, quote unquote, far right guy, and he's not going to be able to have a position in the cabinet. Because it turns out that this guy here, Herbert Kickl, was the guy who got caught in the was a Russian honey trap. I don't know if you remember this story from a few years ago that brought down the previous right-wing government in Austria. And I don't know if it was actually a Russian woman or it was a woman posing as a Russian, as like the daughter of a Russian oligarch who was going around entrapping these European politicians. And they would then secretly videotape them and they would promise, make them say nice things about Russia or whatever. Like it wasn't anything too salacious, but it was like, you know, hey, would you like to have this deal? I'll arrange something with my father in Russia and we'll do it. And so kind of making it seem like the politicians were engaged in some kind of scandal and corruption. And then that was leaked to the press. It was a setup. And this guy who's now the head of the largest party in Austria, he was sort of caught up in that. He was entrapped in that sort of situation that brought down the previous government. He was kicked out of the party, but he came back he wasn't kicked out of the party, but he was kicked out of the government. And he came back and he sort of took over the Freedom Party and has taken it to the heights that it is now. He's not quite doubled, but almost doubled their results since the last election. So that's quite impressive. But you can see basically people fed up with election shenanigans or election interference. We basically had a conspiracy to bring down the previous right-wing government. And that seems to have actually done, in the end, seems to have been quite beneficial for the Freedom Party, you know, four or five years on.
Yeah, there's right across the Western world, there's this attitude that exists in the sort of the liberal, you know, the liberal right-wing parties, the liberal conservative mainstream national party analogues, that we want to keep the so-called far right, the people who are concerned about patriotism and borders and national identity, we want to exclude those people. We want to keep them at arm's length, keep them away. And they'll actually go to quite extreme lengths to try and make sure that they, more extreme lengths than they go to for any other party, to exclude them from power and make sure they never do any coalition deals or make any concessions to them at all. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that you've got Russian women running around trying to entrap people. I imagine there'll be all sorts of dirty tricks that will be deployed and people are willing to deploy in future to try and derail the chances of right-wing parties. But the collapse of some of these centre-right parties is a direct result of this attitude, because it's they are, by their nature, unable to respond to the problems that are the big problems in politics around the Western world now, problems caused by immigration, problems caused by some of the liberal economic policies, problems to do with national identity, culture, diversity, multiculturalism, all these issues, because the ideological framework that they work off says that problems like that don't exist or shouldn't exist. And that if they do exist, the thing that must be causing it is the racist attitudes of the people in the country. And so the solution, if there is one, to those problems is always to crack down on the domestic population and their horrible racist attitudes, as if that's going to solve the problem, because any real problem cannot exist according to the way of thinking that they have.
When I interviewed the chairman of the AfD recently, he sort of pointed out that in Germany, they were saying, oh, these parties who had lost the election were saying, oh, we're going to form a government of the democratic parties, the pro-democracy parties. We're going to exclude the anti-democratic people, which is over a third of the population who's voted for the largest party. They're anti-democratic, we're going to get rid of them. And it seems like you may have something similar forming here in Austria, where the Freedom Party will be excluded. You've got the socialists, these liberals, basically saying they're going to try and work together so they can cut out the Freedom Party, they can cut out these nationalists. And I was just speaking earlier with Dave Green about effectively the kind of the post-World War II order, post-World War II consensus, and kind of the lies that keep this going. And there's sort of an agreement they're going to keep up these false pretenses that everybody knows are not true. And you basically see that play here, where you have these the media as well say, well, it's the first time the far right has won since 1940 or since 1930 and so on. So the first time since World War II that they're a right-wing victory and so on. So they frame it in this way that if you vote for the Freedom Party in Austria, you're repudiating the consensus that was built up after World War II. You're trying to tear down the mythology of World War II. And that's effectively what I see is happening. It seems to be, would say it's inevitable that this has to happen, that that World War II mythology, the lies of liberalism and equality that were built up after World War II, they just don't hold up and they're going to collapse. And it's better that people actually support the replacement of that with something better rather than having these liberal elements conspire to basically have the whole system come crumbling down around them and saying, we will rule over the ashes kind of approach.
Yeah, I mean, the dynamic is, or what they're suggesting is that if you're against mass immigration, if you're against multiculturalism, if you're against sort of diversity, or you have concerns with diversity, then the only real alternative is Nazism and you must be a Nazi. And then, you know, out come the concentration camps, out comes, you know, the goose-stepping soldiers, and we're going back to totalitarianism. There can't be any middle ground where you just have a normal democratic country, but without mass immigration and multiculturalism, that which is obviously that's what most people want, I think. Now, pretending that alternative doesn't exist, and it's either diversity, multiculturalism, or Nazism, and there's no middle ground. So it's just silly. It's not true.
And sort of to segue away from this subject to a different part of the world, while strangely it being tied to, you know, sort of tied to policy in many countries, is the situation in Israel at the moment, Gaza, Lebanon, Iran. As I mentioned, in Austria, you had a party that got 0.4% of the vote, which is pretty decent, nearly 20,000 votes on Gaza issues, like Palestinian issues. So you basically have a faction of like foreign interests that are trying to embed themselves into your democracy. And that part of that conflict in a different part of the world is a big deal. In Europe, it's a big deal. People in America are talking about it, and we'll get to America in a moment. Even in New Zealand, often, you know, what's going on in Israel, what's going on in Palestine is the big issue. The Maori Party released press releases on its policy on supporting Iran and last week and so on, and they protest in favor of Gaza. The Green Party do this. Very common. You have other politicians who will come out in favor of Israel, and you know the ACT Party coming out saying they officially disagreed with the Prime Minister and with Winston Peters, the Foreign Minister, on his position on Israel. Who cares should kind of be the response, but really it matters. It seems to matter a lot what's going on there, and it seems to be tied to, again, the international rules-based order of World War II and Israel sort of making a mockery of this international rules-based order. That seems to be the cause of the contention in our countries. Putting the actual conflict, the specifics of who's throwing rockets into who and who's to blame, that seems to be the issue of, is there an international rules-based order that Israel is basically violating by saying that they, you know, they can do what they like, which I agree with that in the sense of I'm a bit old school that way, but that's causing the problems, right? Because some people want there to be an exception.
Well, I think one thing is that as we've become increasingly globalized, all conflicts kind of become global conflicts. the political conversations that are going on in each individual country have sort of merged, and we all start sort of talking about and caring about the same things. So, and that's just to do with, you know, the flows of people and the flows of information now are moving much more frequently between countries. And so the type of things that we care about are necessarily converging. And there's dangers to that because, as we know, there are things like mind viruses, the woke mind virus. And if there are no sort of natural sort of borders in terms of the information that spreads throughout cultures, then if you get a particularly virulent and particularly dangerous mind virus that, you know, harms your society, it can spread across all these different societies. So there's no sort of natural safety net. But you were saying that part of the problem is that this Israel is being perceived as flouting the international rules-based order, and that's driving a lot of this. Well, I think there's it's a very tough situation over there for Israel and also for the Palestinians, the people in Gaza. Both sides have it tough, and they both sort of bring it on themselves to a certain extent because they're both, they both have this sort of eye for an eye foreign policy.
Yeah, it's tit for tat. Same thing with Iran, right? We're bombing you for this because of the thing that you did, and then the other side says, no, we're bombing you because of this thing that we did. Sort of the endless revenge, kind of tribal Utu. Blood calls for blood, and it never ends, and you have to keep going. But
there is such a thing as an international rules based order, and of course people don't always follow the rules of the rules based order, but often they do. And international law is a real thing that nations follow often, and it's arisen organically in the same way the common law sort of arose in England. Disputes arise, disputes need to be sorted out, the solutions to disputes become remembered, and over time they form into sort of soft kinds of rules, and then those soft solutions, they get sort of institutionalized. It becomes the normal way of doing things. The problem with international law is, and the international rules-based order, is there's no sort of ultimate hegemonic power that can always enforce the rules. Sometimes the nations work together to enforce the rules. But in this case, you've got Israel flouting the rules. And of course, the people who would normally be enforcing the rules would be the USA. And the USA backs Israel. So you've got the International Criminal Court saying that, condemning what Israel is doing, calling it, a genocide, or it's getting quite close to genocide, what they're doing in Gaza. The occupations of the occupied territories have been condemned now, I think, several times. But there's no action that really can be effectively taken until the US decides to align itself with international law rather than with Israel. And I don't see any indication that that's something they're going to do soon. So, the US has to make a decision what side of the fence it wants to be on there, and it's sticking with Israel. And so that's going to increasingly bring international law into disrepute and or the US into disrepute, depending on what side of the fence you're on there.
Well, speaking of the United States, there was a debate last week, vice presidential debate between Tim Walz and J.D. Vance. And what were your thoughts of that debate?
Well, it was a little bit of a contrast with the Trump-Kamala Harris debate, which was memorable for some of the outrageous comments. Well, not really outrageous, but, like the Haitian migrants eating pets and comments like this that got, viral comments that got conversations going. So we had a lot of fun with that. But this was a more serious, more like a traditional political debate where it was very issues-based, and there was agreement between the guys. It was more intellectual, to be frank.
In a large part, this has to do with who's setting the tone of the debate, and since that J.D. Vance is more so an intellectual, he's someone who likes to actually answer questions, and he's the clearly the biggest persona, at least in that debate. He has the most personality. He's able to drive issues and able to make the conversation about what he wants it to be about. And Trump does something similar, but he does it in his own Trumpian way, which is, you know, Trump's not an intellectual. He's an artist or, you know, of some kind, rhetorical, so I'm going to say genius, the greatest. And so that actually plays like a massive impact, I think, on any debate that either of them are in. That if you have J.D. Vance there, it's always going to be framed as an intellectual debate. And I see that as quite a positive thing. I mean, I'm a little bit, consider myself a little bit more of an intellectual, very impressed with Vance, definitely as far as politicians go. On the international stage, he's been one of my favorites, like all-time favorites almost. You know, I'm not that old, of course. So I can't have that many all-time favorites, but he's definitely one of the most impressive Republicans that I've seen, if not the most impressive.
Yeah. Ever since Trump burst on the scene, he's slowly developed a stable, a cadre of intellectuals who have sort of explained Trump to the intelligentsia, they've produced the intellectual justifications for the positions Trump has taken.
Yeah, like what is Trumpism, right? Trump didn't invent or define it, but you've had these people like J.D. Vance who are able to basically create an ideology of or a framework for Trumpism.
And yeah, and that's, I think he's one of the chief, as you said, framework creators. You put it better than I did, but yeah, that's what he's done. And that was on show. He explained intellectually the rationale for many of Trump's positions. And I think the time has actually come for many of these arguments. One of the central arguments has been immigration. In this debate, it's moved on more to economic policy. And I think just prior to the debate, Trump published an opinion piece outlining his new American industrialism, which is a policy sort of hinted at in the past, but he's sort of fleshed it out more fully here, where he's going to implement a tariff, and he's going to reduce corporate taxes and have cheaper energy within America. So the deal he's basically offering to firms is if you set up and do business in America, employ American workers, manufacture your products in America, we'll give you low corporate tax rates, we'll give you cheap energy, we'll give you a great deal, and you have access to our market. If you want to set up outside and try and import your products into the US, you're going to have to pay a tariff. So he's setting up a series of incentives that will incentivize firms, hopefully, all working well, to set up within America and do business there and employ American workers rather than elsewhere. And this, I think, is a much needed change in policy from America. For a long time, there's been a bipartisan consensus in favor of free trade. The problem with that is, this isn't all one-sided. There are benefits to a free trade policy.
Yeah, free trade tariffs. That's my, it's been my policy position. But I'll let you carry on.
Yeah, but a conventional economic analysis will tell you that if you have a developed and a developing country and you liberalize trade between those two countries, then overall you will have more output and more consumption. However, there's distributional effects. The people who benefit in the developed country are the owners of capital, you know, the investor class. And the people who benefit in the developing country are the workers. Because what happens is to take advantage of the cheap labor, the businesses get set, you know, they go and invest in the developing country and employ the cheaper labor. And so those workers benefit. But however, your own workers in the developed country are worse off. And so that's exactly what's happened over the last few decades, is that American workers and workers in many other places in the Western world who have embraced this policy, their median wages in the US, I don't think, have increased for decades. And this policy has a large amount to do with it. And yet the rich have got richer. And so you've created this class of people, wealthy investors, and increasingly their loyalty to the US can be doubted. They see themselves as a global class. They have, they live in several different places. They have houses in many different countries. They have businesses all over the world. They're not necessarily loyal to your country anymore. So you've eviscerated your middle class, given all the wealth to these this investor class who are no longer loyal to your country. So it hasn't been a good deal. And
politically, they tend to favor progressive causes, more liberal causes. They'll basically socially left-wing, as long as they can continue to enjoy the benefits of the current economic arrangement. And so you see this, I guess, in New Zealand as well, where you have the kind of centre-right parties are like heavily socially liberal and economically, what they call quote-unquote economically conservative. And there's a massive pressure, as you say, from that investor class for the politics of the country to be rearranged that way.
Yeah, they have a lot of political and lobbying power, and they use it to further their interests. The other angle here that is neglected often by economists who think about this problem is the geopolitical angle. China has inherited, as a result of these policies, a huge manufacturing base, and it has a wealthier population. And now it's a more fearsome geopolitical and potentially military competitor as a result. Now, the economists, the liberal economists for a long time have believed that if you incorporated China into this international trading system, it would pacify them. They would feel like they didn't need to go to war because they were getting all the benefits of mutual cooperation and trade. However, in practice, it's doesn't look like that's what's happened. It looks like they've banked the economic benefits and they've bulked up their military and now they're taking over.
Yes, well, I was just about to say, the economists, I remember doing all this and studying economics in my late teens, early 20s, and the economists would love to say, well, this is great because, no two countries with McDonald's have ever gone to war with each other and bombed each other. Well, I think that's kind of disappeared in the last 2 or 3 years because now we have multiple countries with McDonald's bombing each other. So, it's a great argument. This thing hasn't happened. Well, now it has. So that means we have to reassess the arguments that these economists were making, thinking maybe they were not quite right. And this one of my favorite moments from the debate, I think maybe it's flown under the radar, but I believe they're talking about this industrial policy, but from the perspective of pharmaceuticals, so saying, the pharmaceuticals are made by countries that are increasingly hostile to us. Can we really trust those pharmaceuticals? And Vansel's basically said, well, the experts, same thing, the economists and the doctors and all the experts say this is how things should be done. And he responded basically, well, with all due respect, I think we've had enough from experts in the last few years and we just need some common sense policy. And I think just to have someone there on that debate stage smack down this rule by experts that we've had, well, the experts all agree we should do it this way. And someone say, well, we've heard enough of those experts. Let's do what the people want. Let's do what makes sense from our national interest.
Yeah, there's only so many times you can hear Michael Baker be for masks before he was against them, before you start being a bit more skeptical about what the experts are saying. The whole notion of expertise has sort of been corrupted now because the people in power realize that credentials, that expertise, that experts is really, it's a leverage point which you can use to influence public opinion. And so they wheel out these experts and prime them up to say what the people who are behind them want them to say to further the interests. They're using the idea of expertise, but really what they're there to do is to further someone's interests, the interests of their backer who's wheeled them out there to say it. And this has resulted in people losing faith in experts because the experts aren't really giving you objective advice about what the best thing is. They're telling you what someone wants you to hear. So there's no more faith in experts anymore as a result of that.
And before we move on to domestic issues, and I think we'll talk about the manufacturing and so on from a New Zealand perspective in a moment, but one final thing from the debate that ties in with a data dump that was done a few days ago by a congressman, it was a House Republican in America, showing that there were over 650,000 migrant criminals and suspects in America at the moment. So 650,000, well over 500,000 migrant criminals in America. And this, again, gives a lot of evidence to Trump's campaign, where he's been saying, highlighting the fact that there's a massive amount of crime going on in America that is done by people who just shouldn't be there. There's a lot of arguments that will come back. Well, local people commit crimes too. Yeah, okay, but you can deal with them because they're supposed to be where they are. But the people that are committing crimes that aren't supposed to be in your country, what are they doing there? Can we get rid of them? And the debate highlighted as well that the majority of Americans supported Trump's mass deportation policy, a vast majority or a good majority, even left-wing polls were showing a clear majority supporting Trump's deportation policy. All of that very, very positive for Vance in that debate.
Yeah, over 50% supporting mass deportations, if I remember correctly. But yes, huge numbers of illegal migrant criminals roaming free in the US. And this is another case of what people thought was hyperbole, exaggeration from Trump, you know, rhetorical flourish that's turned out to be absolutely true. They're not sending their best. They're sending rapists. They're sending murderers. They're emptying the prisons. They're sending them here. They're emptying the mental institutions. Well, there's over 500,000 illegal alien criminals, according to this data released by a US government department, running around. There's tens of thousands of murderers, illegal criminal murderers, running around inside the US. Anyone ought to be concerned about that. This is a terrible failure, that people like that need to be taken off the streets. And they're not being taken off the streets. They're being put onto the streets by this failed immigration policy. So they're either going to have to be locked up in prison, or they're going to be deported. And it's better to deport them, because that's, you know, so there's no real option to get out of doing something with a lot of these people. There's going to have to be mass something or other to deal with the problem anyway. So bring on the mass.
Yeah, and if you do mass incarcerations, the left will complain too. And America already has an insanely high imprisonment rate, and they don't really need to just be filling up their prisons with more people. Far easier to send them back to the countries who created them to begin with.
If you put them in prison, the left will just let them out again later on anyway.
Yeah, well,
get them out of the country. It's harder to get them back in again.
That's right. You'll get a Labor government just like we had, empty the prisons, and then you have crime through the roof.
It's like something from a Batman movie, you know, like they empty Arkham Asylum and, you know, like then Batman has to come in and get the people. Like, that's what they're doing. It's like villain behavior.
I think they call it predictive programming. They get like Hollywood to make movies about it, and then they do it to you in real life.
Mm.
Now, back to New Zealand. Industrial policy in New Zealand, I think, is worth talking about. We touched very briefly last Monday about the oil and gas ban ending, and we spoke about that. But I think there's a lot more to be said on that, especially economic issues in New Zealand. We had a freezing works close as well, or a closure was announced. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about your views on industrial policy for New Zealand. What's happening right now? And Shane Jones seems to be the only one making any noise about it.
It was mainly Shane Jones. There are other people as well. There are people within ACT, like Simon Court, for example, who's making some very good comments, and others.
Good to hear.
But yes, it's interesting the parallels between what's happening in New Zealand and what's happening in the US and what's happening in Europe. I mean, the pushback against the green policies in Europe, the climate change policies, a lot of the anti-farmer policies, that's happening in Europe too, and similar things are happening here. The Ardern government put in place a ban on oil and gas. We've also had these climate change policies. We've got an ETS, and we've got these net zero, or not the net zero, whatever the climate goals are that we're aiming at, and all this, and then we've got a plethora of farm regulations coming down the pipe, and that's to do with water, but it's also to do with climate. It's also to do with several other things, like about health and safety. There's a whole bunch of things, and these policies combined, I mean, the it's making energy more expensive, and it's making business harder. And then we've got the tree planting policies, which are converting a lot of good farmland into pine forests. So all these things are sort of working together to make business out in the provinces, particularly rural and primary sector businesses, harder. It's hastening the closing of some of these meat plants. I mean, there's been a long-term process of the closure of meat plants anyway, because dairy has displaced a lot of sheep farming in New Zealand. So the sheep numbers have been going like that for a long time and being replaced by cow numbers. But now we've got trees as well, replacing many of the sheep farms. And so the way these, you don't need so many meat processing plants if you've got trees and dairy cows instead of lamb. So these things are closing down, and it doesn't help that energy prices are going up as well. that's closing down many other things. And so there just needs to be a reassessment, I think, if we want to have a thriving provincial economies. We need to redress the balance between our environmental goals and our economic goals. And that means putting less regulations on farmers. It means having an energy policy that is sensible. We can strive for better energy efficiency and less pollution over time still without banning entire fuels, relying all on renewables, which, as we've seen, there are, you know, peaks and troughs in the availability of renewable fuels, and the water levels in the hydro lakes aren't always stable if you have droughts and you don't have enough.
It causes big problems with prices as well, price spiking and unreliable pricing, all of that very, very damaging to business.
Do you need to have, you know, we've got the coal-fired Huntly plant and we're putting Indonesian coal in it now. So we don't, there's plenty of coal in New Zealand we could be digging up, but we don't because of environmental goals. So there's just a lot of things that we're doing that don't make sense. We need to have coal, we need to have gas, we need to do more mining, we need to have less regulations on the farmers. And we can still do all those things in a way that protects the environment. We just need to redress this balance.
But the really big part of this problem, and we discussed this last week very briefly as well, I think, was that long-term security, especially businesses, they need to know, I'm going to put effort into this, that I'm not going to get shut down. And it seems to be a really big risk of that in New Zealand, the risk that the Greens, the risk that Labour will get back into power. And ironically, of course, yeah, the Labour Party is supposed to be the party of the working man, but they're basically, you will just shut down your businesses, put hundreds and thousands of workers out of business because they're working in effectively industrial, employed in industry, and it's not office jobs, right? That's basically, office jobs are more environmentally friendly. Let's have more office jobs.
Yeah, but, you know, man cannot live on office jobs alone.
Well, absolutely, right? But to know that you're going to have a government at some point in the future, like inevitably, there's going to be a left-wing government unless we can find a way to permanently crush the left in New Zealand. It doesn't seem likely to happen. The only way that I think the only countries where something like that happens is like they're in a permanent state of war. Israel's a good example. There's like no left-wing in Israel. You don't have to worry about that. They used to have no left-wing at all because you're always at war and nobody's interested in being a leftist when there's a war on. But you can't make a war. So in New Zealand, that's not going to work. So we need something else that's going to give us a long-term industrial policy.
Yes, a long-term industrial policy would be good. Simon Court is working on a cross-party accord on natural gas, which if he could convince people on the left to sign up to, would be one way of handling the natural gas problem. I'm skeptical they will sign up to it, given that their policy is to abolish natural gas. So
yeah, a way to do this, like this, the same thing can be done when it comes to infrastructure, is you have an agreement where you both give up something and you both get something, and or maybe you have a system whereby you can focus, you know, when you're in government, you can focus more on XYZ, but ABC is still going to happen, you know, that you're not going to completely shut that down. So hopefully they're coming at it from that approach to say, okay, well, we'll work on some of the things that we normally wouldn't work on, that we would normally shut down, you know, that you want to do, and try and find some kind of balance there. That would be my approach. But you're not always dealing with sane people when you're, especially because the climate goals are not really about this so-called climate emergency, because there are very quick, easy fixes to fixing a lot of energy production around the world, right? Like nuclear power is a classic example where you could basically stop almost all pollution from energy production. You could stop it if you built enough nuclear power plants, but you're not going to get that out of the Green Party. No, it all has to be, you know, we need to use less energy, less human activity, for anti-human stance. We need to have degrowth. You know, we need the economy to shrink. We can't use more resources. Very, very negative view of human flourishing.
There's definitely an element within the left and green movements that is hostile to economic activity. and even human activity. It's sort of the way they've defined it. Anything that humans do is inherently unnatural and is harmful to the environment, and that things are always better if they're pristine and free from humans, right? But humans, it's not really like that, because humans are creatures, the part of the environment fundamentally. It's the way you've defined it. But yeah, this anti-human stance, it's really problematic. And it's all the way through into the UN now as well. So, you know, there are people who want, there's the Club of Rome. It's existed for a long time, that wants to reduce the human population to reduce the load on the environment. And a lot of this thinking is based on Malthusian arguments, right? That as the human population goes up, the demand on the Earth's resources will go up. And necessarily, then we will deplete the Earth's resources and despoil and ruin the environment. But a lot of the evidence says it doesn't actually work that way, because as the population has increased, you've had more human minds applying themselves to problems, and we've learned to use the resources we have more efficiently. And that effect of using resources more efficiently has outpaced the increased demand in resources that the increased population has created. So we've actually become, as the human population has grown, we've actually used the resources more efficiently. We've learned to get by using less resources. And you can see this easily if you look at the productivity of farmland. The amount of meat, the amount of milk, for example, we can get off the same plot of land now than compared to 100 years ago is hugely increased just by increases in the efficiency of our farming, the efficiency of our growing. You know, we've got fertilizer, we've got all these amazing chemicals we've developed. We can remove pests. The size and quality and nutrition and a lot of the products we produce is much better now than it was. And this effect is duplicated not just in agriculture, but across many industries. So the Club of Rome, I think, is wrong. I think Malthusian economics is wrong. More human beings is a good thing, because it means more human minds applying themselves to problems and coming up with solutions. And the more human, more people we have doing that, the more problems we can solve more quickly.
On the subject of the left-wing goals, there seems to be a continued progressive march, even from our current so-called right-wing government. The ACT Party has, amended. I think there are regulations that they can amend in the Internal Affairs Department. So you've got the ACT Deputy Brooke van Velden, who has changed the way that birth certificates work in New Zealand, saying that mothers and fathers or parents can choose if they want to be named as a mother or father or a parent on children's birth certificates. So there's all of the little tweaks that are continually made to documentation in New Zealand. We've had this, this is part of the overall transgender, transsexual movement. I talked about this with Dave Green just before, where he was highlighting how the gay movement basically had applied itself to achieve these goals, and that the arguments people made was, well, if we just let them have what they want, then they'll be happy and they'll put their energy somewhere else and things will quiet down. But as Dave highlighted very astutely, no, they just redirected all their resources to the next thing and they keep moving, and there's never an end. And this seems to be then sort of the next step here in terms of changing birth certificates in New Zealand. So they wanted people, I think the Labour government did this, where you could change your own gender on your own birth certificate, and now your parents can change their genders on their kids' birth certificates. And it's just part of the leftward march through New Zealand's institutions. And it's being done by a former Green Party member who's the deputy leader of the ACT Party in a supposedly right-wing government.
Mm. Yeah, so this is what they're saying, is this is just a minor tweak, you know, just to match up the rules around what gender you put on your birth certificates for your kid with the rule that they passed a few years ago now, which they passed unanimously to allow people to change the gender on their own birth certificate. So this is just a minor regulatory, you know, tweak to align what's going on here with the rule they already passed. What was amazing about that? Well, that's what they say. That's not what I think, of course.
No. I. It's. But they do it in such a innocuous way. Oh yes, it's just a little, thing. We're just making a little tweak, and we're just lining things up and smoothing things out. Except it never stops. It just keeps going, and the next thing, and the next thing, and the camel, the camel's nose in the tent. Although in this case, we're well past that. We've got dozens of camels in the tent.
The camel is walking away with the tent. You've got no tent anymore. But it's amazing that the law they passed a few years ago, they passed unanimously in the New Zealand Parliament. Most people in New Zealand, even now, don't think that, you know, men can become women and you can just change and people should be able to do that. Yet the Parliament passed it unanimously. There's just a huge disconnect in New Zealand's Parliament.
And there's not a single MP there who spoke out against it. None of these so-called conservative national MPs were willing to put their, you know, their further careers on the line by saying no. Just completely unanimous. No dissenting voices. That all been completely silenced by the party machinery, and just such a terrible thing. There's not enough noise made about it.
Yeah, and the idea is that if we go along with what the transgender people think about their own gender, that we're being kind and tolerant and open-minded towards them. But I mean, I just question that whole way of thinking about it. If you're a man and you think you're a woman, that's a mental illness. And sort of indulging that mental illness and going along with it and pretending like it's not a mental illness, are you really helping people by doing that? Aren't you harming them? Aren't you preventing them from realizing that they're wrong about something important, that they're misunderstanding reality? And not only are you harming them, I mean, I think you're harming everyone else. You're forcing everyone else to try and empathize with and think like a mentally ill person, which kind of has the effect, I think, of making everyone else in society, making the society itself a little bit mentally ill.
Yeah, this is a big part of the lies that sustain liberalism. And you know, in the 20th century, we could refer to this as the long 20th century. I've seen that term used a few times. We're living in the long 20th century, and the very idea that underpins it, the liberal ideas, well, we just let people do what they want and they'll be happy. And it's not working. It's obviously not working. But people, you know, aren't people still afraid to say it? Still afraid to just come out and say, no, hang on a minute. Just letting people do whatever they want, that is actually harmful to them. It's harmful to you and me. And it's harmful to all of society because we are being buried in these lies.
That's right. I agree. I mean, and people make stupid decisions, and they make stupid decisions that harm themselves and other people. And sometimes one stupid decision leads to another, if you know what I mean. And that can happen in the case of individuals or even whole societies, if you know what I mean. And at a certain point, it becomes difficult. If you get, you know, you're digging yourself into a hole when you do this, and it becomes difficult for you then to make the correct decision at all because you're so buried in bullshit. And that's, I think, what's happening to us as a society. It's getting increasingly difficult for us to see what is sane and what is true and what is good collectively. The Prime Minister, Chris Hipkins, couldn't define publicly what a woman was. When he was asked by the press gallery, that's just incredible, and it's a sign of sickness in our society. We need to try and fight our way out of this and get back to something sensible.
Well, thank you. I think that's an excellent moot point to end the segment on. I appreciate you coming back on the show every week, and very much enjoy going over these points. And we always get some good bits of feedback. Just let the listeners know one last time, text on 2057, email inbox@realitycheck.radio. And Amy will be on right after this to go through last week's feedback. Thank you again for joining me, William.
Thanks, Stuart.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to? Or dislike what you're listening to. Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you. So connect with us today.